You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Robert. How are you?
I'm just doing wonderfully. Let me introduce it. I'm Robert Wright, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Paul Bloom, famous psychologist. You used to teach at Yale. Now you teach at the University of Toronto, so we know which side of the border you're planting your flag on in this increasingly bitter conflict. And you are publisher and sole author of what may well be the most famous of all the Substack newsletters that are called Small Potatoes.
Congratulations. It is the biggest of the small potatoes.
Mm-hmm. Easily. It's not close. Not close. I don't want to offend anybody. We don't want to get into that, but not close.
So, Bob, yeah. Can I raise something?
Sure.
I really enjoy every 2 weeks getting together with you, and I think it's sort of...
Thank you for raising that, Paul.
There's more.
Oh, that was preamble?
There's more.
It was
preamble. Hmm. You know, I think we both get a lot out of it. It's all good. But I also know that you have many other conversations about every aspect of the political scene, domestic, foreign. You're talking about Trump all the time, talking about Musk all the time. What if
I'm a Renaissance man? Is that what you're getting to, Paul? I cover a lot of territory.
You cover a lot of territory, Renaissance man. Yes. What if we just didn't ever talk about Elon Musk or Donald Trump? We just discussed broader philosophical topics, free will, simulations, historical things, cultural issues, movies, TV shows. And we studiously ignored all mention of those two people.
You're suggesting that we go a week without talking about Musk and Trump?
I am leading with the suggestion that we never, ever fucking talk about those guys again. But I'll settle for a week.
Paul, do you know what dangerous and destructive psychological syndrome you are now evincing?
Is this Trump and Musk derangement syndrome?
No. The opposite.
Oh, okay.
It is chaos desensitization syndrome. You're becoming inured to the chaos they're generating, and this is what they want, Paul. They want to lull you to sleep, and then you wake up and, ooh, looks like I'm in the 51st state. Maybe I should have been a little more politically engaged when Bob tried to help me out.
You're saying it's my moral duty to keep focus.
Yeah.
Not to turn my head, you know.
As a citizen of Canada, as a citizen of the world, that's right. Unless you'd rather privilege your psychological comfort over the welfare of the world. It's your call, Paul.
I'm not persuaded that our conversations actually make the world better.
Oh,
I mean, they entertain and amuse.
What?
They entertain, they amuse, they may inform.
No, I think we have real, that's a very threatening thing you just said, Paul. I can't live with that. My psychological comfort demands that I reject that. No, we're very influential. And the question is, how do we want to use the influence? Now, your fellow Canadians, I might note, it seems to me, by and large, do not share your privileging of psychological comfort over, well, let's just say patriotism. There's a lot of anti-American rage on your side of the border. That's what I'm told.
There is. You're not
wrong.
That's
what seems to me to be in order.
Though I think, to be fair, it's mostly anti-Trump rage.
Actually, it's funny you should say that. I heard your new prime minister on day one, I think, of his tenure. He's in the Liberal Party, and he will soon face an election to see if
Mark
he can
Carney.
Remain prime minister. And he started a sentence. He said, the Americans want to, and then he finished it with something like take our country or something pretty dramatic.
Yeah.
But I was really struck by the fact that he didn't. I mean, he has done plenty of singling out of Trump.
Yeah.
But the fact that he now thinks... And granted, this guy is not like a seasoned electoral politician. He's more of like
a banker. Yeah.
But he seems to think that you can get political mileage in Canada by demonizing all Americans. Now that I'm not kidding here. That's a significant milestone if it's that bad.
Yeah, it's less polite than you'd expect from us, among other things.
Defies stereotypes, yes.
Before we do a deep dive in this, I assume you're aware of the parallels here between Mark Carney and Kim Campbell.
The Kim Campbell?
The Kim Campbell. So you go back, Kim Campbell was the first and only female prime minister of Canada. And
of course.
She was a member of the Progressive Conservatives. And when Brian Mulroney, after a very successful career as a conservative prime minister, stepped down from his party, Kim Campbell rose up. And I don't know if it's the same time of year or whatever, but she became prime minister. Exactly the sort of situation which you don't really have in the States, but she became prime minister, having never been elected to the position. And then they were totally trounced by the Liberals in the upcoming election, making her tenure as prime minister.
This is not the shortest. Early 90s or something?
93.
Inauspicious. Who do you think? Well, we don't quite know when the election will be, right?
No, you have to call it. You call it. But it has to be reasonably soon, next few months.
And for people not having paid attention to this, Trump has single-handedly resurrected the hopes of the Liberal Party for retaining power, because the kind of Trumpist, as Canadians go, Trumpist candidate on the conservative side has been significantly diminished politically by association with Trump, now that Trump is widely reviled in Canada.
It's a little, it is complicated. It goes back to what the phrase you used before about chaos. It's typical Trumpian chaos that he might have inadvertently given hope to the Liberals. So the polling data before Trump got elected, and as well as the betting market, said the conservatives run by Pierre Poilievre, a sort of Trump light, I think Trump very light, but a conservative guy. He was the shoo-in to win. He was like 99% in the betting markets. You could just, and then this happened, and Poilievre's association with Trump became a negative. And suddenly the much reviled prime minister, Justin Trudeau, all of a sudden became popular by fighting back against Trump. And now the Liberals have, you know, maybe the Liberals will take it.
That would be amazing.
And also Trump, you know, so Poilievre sort of had to play catch up, and he said some critical things about Trump. And I think at some news conference, Trump was asked, you know, so what do you think of the conservative guy in Canada? And Trump says, well, I hear he said some not so nice things about me. Maybe he won't be prime minister after all.
And, you know, if you're wondering whether Trump will pick up on the fact that he's damaging the Canadian politician who should be his ally, I believe the answer is no, because he's still talking about the 51st state thing. Yeah. Let me give you a quote. You'll be happy to hear that he speaks very flatteringly about Canada. He said, this was after the latest development was, so Doug Ford, who is like the equivalent, we would call a governor of Ontario, right?
Yeah, premier.
He decided to get into the fray and say he was going to start adding a 25% surcharge to on electricity that flows into the U.S. from Canada, which is kind of funny because that's kind of like a tariff on Canada. But anyway, I guess it makes sense. I guess they've got plenty of electricity. Trump, here I'm quoting the New York Times, went ballistic even by his standard. He says Canada must immediately drop there, and he goes on and on. And then he says, the only thing that makes sense, this is a quote from Trump, is for Canada to become our cherished 51st state. I guess he thought if he added cherished,
well, that sounds pretty good.
Canadians would go, oh, we didn't realize you cherish it. This is totally different. You can have it.
It'd be nice to be cherished.
He cherishes you.
Yeah. I've been lucky and fortunate in my life during Trump's first term, throughout his career, view him as somewhat of a comical figure. And I have not been personally affected. But this is like, this lasts, 50 days. I have friends in academia in the United States who have lost their funding, are losing their funding, who are seeing their universities gutted. And I know people in Canada, it's not really, in my knowledge, it hasn't happened yet. I know people who work in construction, you know, who are really worried that they're going to lose their jobs. They're going to be layoffs and they're going to lose their jobs. And, you know, all because of Trump's chaos monster bullshit.
That's what we need to hear.
That's why I don't want to talk about him anymore. And I, you know, now he's selling Teslas on the front of the White House. And don't you guys have any constraints on what you remember, your president is allowed to do?
You remember that when he first showed up on the scene, before he'd been actually elected president, I'm pretty sure, but he was starting to make way. He had done his big walk down the staircase thing and escalator thing, and he gotten a lot of attention. And he gave a speech, and immediately to his right, there was a stack of, apparently among the things he branded was steaks, like the kind you eat. Yeah. There was like a stack of steaks, and it said Trump steaks. He was like marketing Trump steaks along with his. And I just thought, well, then he won't be taken seriously, right? Wrong. Gets elected. But yeah, so Tesla's, well, you know, Musk. I mean, Musk's, the Tesla stock price has not done well for, it's lost like half its value over the last, I don't know, couple of months or something. For various reasons.
I like Teslas. I've never owned a Tesla, but my sister has one, and I tend to get Ubers, which are Teslas, which always surprises me. But I love the look of it. I love to drive it. You know, there's the disadvantage of electric car, and it's kind of a complicated trade off. But I was very tempted for a little while. Now I wouldn't line Elon's pocket with this. And then there's also the fact that what would other people think of me? I don't want eggs thrown at my car.
Right.
You know, I even like once looked at a Cybertruck and said, huh, this guy, I like the kind of retro, so ugly, it's beautiful sort of thing. But this I could imagine this devastating the company. And Trump promoting Teslas will do some good for Musk, but may do more harm than good overall.
Yeah, I've been trying to think about this. I mean, it is fortunate for Musk that just as he alienated blue state America, he came out with this car that whose natural appeal is, since it's a pickup truck, I mean, is a little more in red state America.
Yeah.
So it can be worn as a badge of honor, I guess, by some of his supporters. It is a little on the pricey side.
How much is the Cybertruck?
I think it's at least 70 or something, but I'm not sure.
Ooh.
I'm not sure. Don't quote me. But it's maybe that's just like the souped up version. Ooh, but it's a lot.
It's Canadian, $115,000.
Yeah,
that's about 70 or something.
And I've got to think that as for people in Trump supporters who want to buy regular Teslas by way of showing their support, going to be pretty tempting to buy one of the many used models now on the market.
Yes.
<that's right. laughs> Like, seriously, that's unfortunate for Musk. You've got all these people who might have found the money to buy new Teslas, and I don't doubt that no few of them will find you can get a pretty damn good deal on a used one. These days. There's like real kind of sabotage and stuff going on. I mean, yeah. I don't know how much of it. There was a Washington Post piece about people, you know, Molotov cocktails at charging stations and dealerships. Yep. And it sounded like just a couple of miscreants, some of them multiple offenders, not that widespread. There hasn't been any of that in Canada that you know of, has there?
I mean, Musk has a history of doing legal challenges to people who don't want to advertise on his site and do things like that. Trump, of course, has a history of trying to imprison and other things to people who are critical of him. And, you know, it's legitimate enough to say people who are actually committing acts of terrorism are terrorists and criminals. But I feel that Trump is quite close to saying that anybody who sort of wants to boycott Teslas is in some way an enemy of the state.
And yeah, I mean, well, if he could argue, look, why not? I mean, he's trying to deport this green card holder at Columbia for leading pro-Palestinian demonstrations, arguing that he was therefore supporting a terrorist organization and doing various other bad things. I don't think I don't think they're claiming he violated the law against material support for terrorist groups. I think they're just saying that if he's not a real citizen, he's a green card holder, they can pretty much say whatever they want and kick him out. But that's tied up in the courts. But yeah, maybe the next step will be, you know, saying that if you don't buy a Tesla, you should be deported or something.
I mean, so there's, we should talk about this, but his attacks on universities in general, but Columbia University in particular. Mm-hmm. And then there's his attacks on sicking the federal government on law firms that are representing opponents of Trump. And I would just think there's a certain point where how blatant does it have to be? I mean, does Trump have to threaten, if you criticize me, I'm going to have you audited? Is there a certain point,
this is for real. I mean, this is, I think, a real threat to civil liberties that he didn't pose the first time around in any significant way. But along a lot of fronts, yeah, he's pushing the envelope. Now, a lot of this stuff is tied up in the courts. And, you know, the initial signs are auspicious in the sense that they're tied up there because some federal court said, no, stop while we figure this out, at least. So some of these things will reach the Supreme Court, and we'll see.
What's the current status of the pro-Palestinian kid? Is he still in some sort of cell somewhere?
I think the courts froze the deportation effort, is my understanding. I can check on that. But I don't understand immigration law, but apparently there's just like a ton of green card holders in America, like many, many millions. And, you know, they customarily, that's thought of as a real security blank, you know, having a green card. It's like the next best thing to citizenship. So there are a lot of people up in arms. I mean, in terms of who's supporting it, the Anti-Defamation League, some people might consider that ironic, but they're supporting the deportation. And I guess a few other people, but a fairly broad.
Sorry, the ADL, whose side are they on?
They're on Trump's.
They're on Trump's side. Okay.
Yeah. No, they generally go with a pro-Israel line at the ADL. Yeah. And but there's a pretty broad, there's a number of fairly pro-Israel people who have come out against Trump. And
I mean, you could be pro-Israel and defend basic rights to protest and free speech and so on.
You would think.
Mm-hmm. It is many are. It is Trump's and Elon Musk, by the way, but Trump's disdain for the right to speak and right to protest is so blatant and shocking and almost of the sort you wouldn't believe it until it happens.
I mean, both he and Elon Musk, I think, favor the law of the jungle. They really do, just in their heart. It's just like might makes right. And in fact, I've said this before on podcasts, but somebody I know who knows Musk pretty well, worked with him fairly closely, told me that, and he, at least at this point when I was talking to him, harbored no ill will. This was a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They were on good terms. And he said, this was before he's a Trump supporter. And the person said, but one thing about him is, like survival of the fittest with him. That's like, you know, it's like his religion. He didn't use that word, but he didn't say social Darwinist, but that's what he meant. And by the way, I just posted a conversation with Eric Levitz, this very prominent journalist at Vox, a couple of days ago. And he had done this piece at Vox about Elon Musk's maternal grandfather. What a whack job. First of all, this guy moved from Canada to South Africa because of apartheid, because it was a cause he could support. And look, none of us should be tarnished by the sins of our grandfathers, with a possible exception of Elon Musk. But this guy also had this whole nutty ideology about how, I understand it, democracy is not working, so we need a ruling of the technocracy. It was almost a religion. The supporters of this, I think, drove gray cars and wore gray suits or something. It's just crazy shit. Now, Musk did not know him because he died when Musk was like a couple years old, but was very close to this guy's wife, apparently, and has spoken favorably about. And then Musk's father, like literally, I think, went crazy around Musk's current age, if not a few years before. And some people speculated there may be some kind of genetic thing going on. But
what was that? You know, so I'm not one to quote Steve Bannon, but I think Bannon described Musk's ethos as what, a techno-feudalism of some sort. And
that's right. He thinks the rich, you know, if you've got power and money, like you, and he's one of these, what drives me crazy about both, their ability to convince themselves that whatever they want is morally right. I mean, when I said they believe in the law of the jungle, I don't just mean they're nihilistic and amoral. I do think they think there's some moral justification in whatever they're doing at the time. But
everybody does.
Yeah, yeah, but we all more often have a plausible case, you know, than they do, right?
Yeah.
It's like, because we're just less often breaking what are reasonable rules than they are.
I mean, particularly Trump, who has this extraordinary disdain for what he would call losers. I mean, losers like, you know, Ukraine.
You and me.
Zelensky. Yeah. Probably you and me with our little podcast. Losers like, you know, there's an old thing from way back when he just said, you know, about derisively about John McCain, who let himself be captured. You know, he prefers the guys who don't let themselves be captured. And it's his corresponding respect for strongmen like Putin, who are very powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, could you imagine? We don't normally talk foreign policy. I'm just going to ask you the question and everything. Can you imagine a reconfiguration of the world where the U.S. is under no, and people right now think the U.S. has done some terrible things, but the U.S. has lost any facade of being the good guys. And now the U.S. simply allies itself with Russia and China and what the hell, North Korea, pits itself against Canada and the EU and everything like this. And there's just this global realignment where all of a sudden we are, more specifically you, are the baddies.
That seems to be underway.
Well, that's pretty fucking awful.
Well, yeah. I mean, what most bothers me that's kind of a subset of is just the explicit advocacy of the law of the jungle in international affairs. You know, we want, I mean, he goes back and forth, you know. First, he suggested he would use military force against Greenland. Then in his State of the Union, he said, well, you know, if they want it or something. And then he kind of added, but, you know, I think we're going to get it one way or the other. You know, he's going to bomb Mexico, use force against Panama if necessary, which I guess won't be now that an American company has bought those and other ports from the or at least the rights to administer them or something. But, you know. Yeah, I don't like him.
No,
I mean, you know, let me just say, I do favor a kind of pragmatic realist foreign policy. I don't think our policy should be so moralistic. I don't think, for example, when Russia invaded Ukraine, to me, the issue wasn't that Ukraine was a democracy. The issue was that invading countries is illegal. And yet almost everyone in America automatically says, oh, my God, it's a democracy. To me, that doesn't really matter. It's like you have this international law against transborder aggression. That's the thing we should uphold. Because if we just start saying, well, as long as it's not a democracy, it's okay, then things start falling apart, I think, which, of course, they've done. But anyway, so that's kind of the subtext of what I said.
In
other words, I'm not saying, oh, my God, now he thinks that the bad guys, the Russians, are good guys.
Yeah.
That's not the way I'd frame the problem.
Yeah.
The problem I'd frame the problem as sheer lawlessness.
Yeah. Yeah. And you could imagine a different kind of leader, you know, behind the scenes and everything, saying, look, you know, Ukraine's going to have to give up something in that we want a ceasefire. Yeah. That's an important thing. But Trump is doing it in a very different way. Trump is just, is you know, delights in the humiliation of people and just,
yeah.
You know, there's a movie out. I know we talk about movies in the other part, but I just want to call Mickey 17 by June Hu, who directed a Parasite a few years ago.
Korean movie.
And it stars Robert Pattinson, and it's a science fiction movie, and it involves cloning. And I found it incredibly disappointing movie. This is an awful movie. But at the core of it is Mark Ruffalo, who is playing... He was playing a character who is has lost several elections off to space with this crowd of people who adore him, and they all wear red hats to express how much they adore him. And he's this bombastic, full of shit guy doing it. And Ruffalo does this Trump imitation, this big puffy Trump imitation. And man, if the movie was unwatchable because it's boring and long and not very coherent, I don't need to see more Trump imitations on the scene. I really am sick of the man.
Yeah.
I've been swearing unusually a lot this time. I had not much sleep, but also just I'm really sick of Trump.
It sounds like maybe you actually need a little chaos desensitization, Paul. I was too quick to judge you. I mean, if your mental health situation is acute, a little dose of desensitization, just in the short run.
Just in the short run. There's so much thing to talk about. You would enjoy it. You could complain again, that simulation theory is incoherent. To talk about God. There's all sorts of stuff. Just for a bit.
Okay. So enough. That's it. I'm not going to mention the fact that he's about to donate another $100 million to Trump controlled PACs, basically, or anything else about. Am I allowed to mention one other sign of the encroaching oligarchy? Just that
this week is lost. So
it doesn't involve Musk. It doesn't involve Musk. This is a different oligarch. This is emerging oligarch Jeff Bezos.
Okay.
The reluctant oligarch.
That's a good title for a book.
The reluctant oligarch is the movie, the biopic about Jeff Bezos. As we had talked about the controversy when David Shipley, who was then the opinion page editor of the Washington Post, had spiked a cartoon ridiculing Jeff Bezos. And I said, look, I mean, I defended not Bezos, but the spiking. This is like, look, nobody is going to let you, you know, run a cartoon ridiculing the owner of your publication. I bet it's never happened in the history of publications. That's not to me surprising. And the cartoonist saying it's never happened to me before. It's like, yeah, have you ever ridiculed the owner of your publication before? Anyway, since then, David resigned, because Bezos, apparently was saying the opinion page is going to change. It's going to be about free markets and liberty. And people took that to mean it's going to be more pro-Trump, less anti-Trump. David talked to him about it and decided to resign because he couldn't enthusiastically support that mission. And then today, Ruth Marcus, a columnist, quit because she wrote a column criticizing this. She's at the Post, or was, and it was spiked by the publisher. I mean, David's successor is not there yet, so I don't think the new regime is in place. But this particular column got spiked, and she is very prominent. In fact, when they were deciding who to hire as opinion editor, David got the job. She was the other main person under consideration. She was the insider under consideration. So that's the latest development on that. And now I yield to you to talk about non-oligarchic.
We'll go for it. Like I said, the week is lost. The stories over and over again of institutions folding to Trump, which started at his inauguration, where everybody ponied up $1 million as sort of service to him. You know, I think all of the major tech industries did, and all the social media people did. And now the universities are being crushed by Trump for reasons that, I don't know. I think there's just multiple reasons. Part of it is because universities are seen as woke and liberal. Part of it
is... That was Columbia, right? That was... explicitly, they said you're not doing enough about anti-Semitism or something, meaning, in other words, the pro-Palestinian protests weren't controlled well enough or something, or the speech of them wasn't policed well enough.
So I mean, it's all American universities, the research universities, are being seriously hit because of changes in funding and indirect costs and so on.
Yeah, like USAID, those cuts did Johns Hopkins was like $600 million.
Yeah. And there's high, I think, I forget, I don't want to get the wrong university, but some universities are having hiring freezes and so on because the amount of indirect costs has dropped and the indirect costs support the research mission of a university. I imagine Trump, I think Trump has some sort of plan to tax the endowments of the richest universities, which will have serious consequences. But Columbia was singled out, and Columbia was singled out. And, you know, I wouldn't want to be president of Columbia because no one's going to be happy with you, but it was singled out for its pro-Palestinian, anti-Israeli demonstrations and for letting the students do it, for allowing, I guess they would say, allowing anti-Semitism to run rampant on campus. And so there's that, and then there's also the fact that the university does not seem, I don't think any universities are fighting back. And maybe it's not a fight that they see themselves as possibly winning.
Yeah, I wondered about that. I always fantasize about people fighting back. And so I wondered when I first heard that they were hitting Columbia with that $400 million penalty, whether like Ivy League presidents would like to have some phone calls with each other and try to and say, look, this is a threat to all, and with other presidents at other universities and build up a network and decide what to do. I doubt it's happening. I mean, I don't. How many profiles in Courage were there during that kind of inquisition supported by Bill Ackman and executed by Elise Stefanik? You know, I don't did any college professors stand up and say much of anything? I mean, college presidents. I'm sorry.
Not to my knowledge, including Yale, where I have a lot of respect for the then president, but no. I mean, they weren't worried about being sanctioned by the government because it was a, you know, Biden. But they were worried about their donors. And they were worried that they would lose money from their donors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could fantasize about the president of Columbia getting together with Harvard and Yale and Stanford. And then what? We are a united front of the top universities in the United States speaking against you, Mr. Trump. About,
well,
really?
I think one thing you could do, some of these universities have ridiculous endowments.
Yeah.
I mean, Princeton has the highest per student endowment in the known universe, I believe. Harvard probably has, maybe Stanford now has a bigger endowment than Harvard's. I don't know.
Harvard has $52 billion.
Mm-hmm. In absolute terms, that's probably, it's either them or Stanford. And I mean, it just seems to be like if some of those just super well endowed, that if they had to, they could dig in. I mean, they wouldn't notice $400 million. If they had to, they could dig in. Like, they could at least get together and, like, make a statement and even maybe do shows of defiance. And, like, yeah, this speaker is coming to campus. And and I suppose Trump could try to say, well, we're going to somehow, you know, fine you for whatever. But, and I don't know how much total federal support these guys get. But first of all, I imagine that beyond a certain level of funding, if Trump tried to take more away, he would be in more and more danger of losing the courts. I don't know. That's just wild conjecture. Yeah. I have no idea. But, you know, geez, I mean, they don't need the money. In fact, at Princeton, which I'm pretty familiar with, there's been this absurd building spree. And you ask people, it's like, wait, you're replacing the old art museum with an uglier one? Like, that is obviously very expensive. The other one was only modestly ugly. Why are you doing this? And one explanation is, well, they're afraid that they're going to be subject to some big endowment tax, so they're spending it while they can. But, I mean, the amount of construction is absurd, and they got a lot of money.
I like the idea of them fighting back. I'm not exactly sure what that entails. I kind of worry whenever, like, the president of Princeton speaks out, two more people vote for Trump. Universities occupy a funny status where at some level there's a lot of respect for, you know, Harvard and Princeton, the great universities. Mm-hmm. People respect that, and I think it's no accident politicians want to put their kids in there. in these really good universities. On the other hand, I think most people see them as too liberal, too elitist, too sneering.
Well, certainly Trump's base. They're not. Yes. I'm sure names like Harvard and Princeton aren't popular in Trump's base. You're right about that. You know, at the same time, and look, I don't want to over-dramatize this thing. I don't think we'll become Nazi Germany per se, but I am no longer ruling out some kind of attempt. I'm not even saying this is on his mind, but you can see a way in 3 years, significant civil liberties have been lost. You can even see a way he's trying to stay in power another term. That would be a blatant contradiction. You can see him trying to deploy the military domestically. You can see a lot of scary shit happening.
I see all of that.
And if you go back and look at these countries where the movement has gone as far as it can go in that direction, like Nazi Germany, there's always these like, well, why didn't this institution stand up? Why didn't these people stand up? And so I take your point, but, you know, I don't know. I don't know. Let me. So how long are we doing this? Yeah, we should move into overtime, as we call it. Probably.
And overtime will be we got severance.
Severance. Also, I'm going to ask you to share with us, how do you really feel emotionally? Don't tell them now. This is the bait, Paul. When you read that somebody has firebombed a Tesla charging station. you might feel bad. Oh, poor Elon, or just feel like, oh, I'm going to resist any temptation and feel good because I know one should not embrace this kind of thing. But we don't know. We don't know what you feel. We don't know what I feel.
You got to go into the. You got to pay the money to know what
you
I gotta
feel. You got to pay up. And I'm gonna do full disclosure. In fact, I'm gonna say things. I could be in jail tomorrow. I could be.
Now I get the idea of how you feel. Like if you
so pay up now.
I hope you're not gonna support a terrorist act because that would make you a terrorist.
Well, that's actually a good point. I mean,
you're already pro Hamas. I mean,
objectively,
you're just piling this up.
Yeah, it's horrible. So. Let's see.
I mean, how's your green card status?
Actually, fortunately, I'm an actual citizen. Yeah, I mean, I'm not actually pro Hamas, of course, but I've said the kinds of things that get people accused of being pro Hamas for sure, and pro Putin and everything else.
I mean, this is so much of this is extremely offensive for anybody who values, you know, free speech, and I think it's shameful if pro Israel organizations say, oh, this is great. You know, we're going to deport people who are critical. It is absolutely shameful.
You should have
enough inside you to say, look, I take this cause extremely seriously and I defend this cause, but I do not want people who disagree with me to be imprisoned.
Yeah, that seems like you could say that. I'm wondering what Barry Weiss said about this. Has she spoken out? Have you heard about Barry Weiss taking a position on this?
No, what did Barry Weiss say?
I don't know. I haven't looked into it.
I've seen an excerpt of Barry Weiss. I've read some of her stuff, and I like it. That I think she's gone very easy in the whole Nazi salute stuff.
That's interesting, because she has been an enforcer of the kind of pro-Israel speech code traditionally. But that's an interesting fact. I hadn't thought about. I'm sure people made a big deal of that on social media. Yeah, let's talk about that too in overtime, man.
Okay.
The stuff is getting weird. Okay, so if you become a paid subscriber to either the Non-Zero newsletter or Small Potatoes, the Small Potatoes newsletter, meaning the most famous of all of them, Paul Bloom's, you get access to all the overtimes and stuff.
Oh, and we're also doing this thing.
We're also doing a 20% discount. So you go, if you can get past the paywall on either, you get this 20% discount to the other one. What's not to like? And you give actual free potatoes. Is that right? Potatoes are shipped to their house.
A potato with every subscription.
Oh, one potato? Just one potato?
A full potato or a nice bag of French fries.
Okay. Okay, folks.
I'll say before we shut off the free thing, I have been unusually grumpy and kind of sweary.
No, you've been fine. You've been fine.
It's just, Trump is really starting to piss me off.
Your nation is embattled. You know, you got an excuse. We're trying to take it over. We're trying to make it the 51st state. You should be.
So here's a question. The common analogy among Trump's worst critics is Hitler. But as far as I know, Hitler was never funny. So is there a character who is very negatively valence Hitler-like, but was also funny? That makes me, we should be thinking about here. Like, Stalin was not funny either, as far as I know.
Yeah. I'm hoping to have the answer to that question by the time we get into overtime. I mean, that's an interesting question. Who is the worst person in history who had a good sense of humor? We'll see if we have an answer on the other side of the overtime wall, folks. But thanks, okay, Everybody. And we will see you in overtime.